Okay, well, today I've been asked to talk to you about the subject of economics, not something that I regard myself as being a particularly an expert on, more specifically the Marxist approach to the subject. Economics is a subject which, let's face it, is regarded by most ordinary people as something akin to the medieval science of alchemy. It's mysterious and totally defying any rational understanding. This is even more true today than 50 years ago. We've seemed to move increasingly over the years away from a capitalist economy which deals with the production of real, tangible things towards the dizzying world of currency, hedge funds, financial futures trading, and the explosion of the service sector. This is why it's no wonder that many activists who are committed to trying to bring about radical social change shy away from the study of capitalist economics, and I include myself in this. However, this is made even more difficult because at the same time, the one thinker who developed a thoroughgoing radical critique of capitalism, Karl Marx, is very little read among people on the left, even those calling themselves socialist revolutionaries. But how can we hope to fight the various forms of oppression and justice and injustice inherent in the capitalist system if we don't actually understand the basic outline of its inner workings? There is a popular misconception among many people on the left that the writings of Marx are so arcane, so mysterious, to be comprehensible to only a select and gifted few. This is unfortunate because despite the perhaps somewhat inaccessible style in which Marx wrote, the basic fundamentals of his philosophy are, I think, in reality, breathtakingly simple. So much so that, in fact, I myself, without claiming to have any kind of level of expertise in economics, can stand here today and talk to you about the basic tenets of Marx's economic theory. And I have a reasonable hope that, you know, perhaps, you know, I'll be understood. Now, in contrast to the bourgeois economists of today who concern themselves only with the surface phenomena of the capitalist system, inflation, prices, interest rates, etc., what Marx actually sought to explain were, as I said, the inner workings and also the historical development of the capitalist system. Marx started from the proposition that economics is basically first and foremost about the way in which society organises to fulfil its immediate material wants. He identified himself as a materialist in opposition to the idealist thinkers who thought that history was determined by the will of a particular deity, the ruling sovereign, or some abstract idea called human nature. Marx describes in his writings that whereas in primitive tribal societies it was possible for individuals to produce the means of their own subsistence through hunting, gathering, etc., with technological advances brought on by agriculture and metallurgy, there was an increasing division of labour, with people fulfilling more and more specialised roles. But in order to satisfy their basic material needs, people now had to produce not just for themselves and for their individual use, but actually to exchange in return for other goods. But how were people to determine the ratio, the value, if you like, at which different products would exchange? Marx explained that this was done on the basis of their one common denominator, the one thing that they had in common, which was the amount of labour time that went into producing a particular article. This exchange value does not necessarily correlate to the original use value, i.e. the practical utility it possesses for us human beings. For instance, diamonds are of very little practical use, but still realise a very high exchange value since their extraction is time-consuming and labour-intensive. Likewise, many things which have a high use value to human beings, such as air, do not command any exchange value at all, at least not yet until they find a way to start charging us for it. Exchange value is determined not at an individual level, but in terms of socially necessary labour time. That is the average time across the whole of the economic sector, and factoring the existing level of technology and specialisation. Therefore, just because I take 30 minutes to produce a watch, which takes 10 minutes for a normal average worker, does not mean I can charge three times the price. Rather, I'd have to work three times as long to produce enough goods to exchange for the same amount of other products. It's important to stress here that when Marx talked about the value of goods being determined by labour time, this is not exactly the same thing as price, since prices are in a constant state of disequilibrium and fluctuate constantly above or below the actual value. As we know, early on in human history, our societies evolved from being mere aggregations of free independent producers to class societies, in which existed on the one hand a large majority of unfree or semi-free labour, and on the other hand a small elite which produced nothing at all, but reserved for themselves the task of ruling over others. But how could they support themselves without labour? Well, the answer, of course, was that they forcibly expropriated the surplus labour of others. That is to say, all of the value created over and above that needed to meet the subsistent needs of the slave or peasant farmer would accrue to the slave owner or feudal lord. This exploitation was transparent and obvious, which is why it could only be justified by recourse to some sort of claim of divine providence, or perhaps simply by brute force. The genius of capitalism, on the other hand, was that in place of this obvious exploitation, it was able to introduce a far subtler form. In an apparent free and equal exchange, the capitalist who owns the means of production would advance to the worker wages in return for gaining control over the worker's labour power. Since all commodities exchange at a value which corresponds to the socially necessary labour time necessary to reproduce them, and here the commodity being exchanged is none other than labour itself, the employer would thus get the better end of the deal. All wages paid go to the upkeep of the individual worker, as well as his family, which ensures the continued survival of the labour supply. However, unlike all other commodities, such as raw materials, plant machinery, etc., labour is unique in that not only is it capable of imparting a portion of its own cost of reproduction into a finished product, but was also capable of creating new value over and above that. Over time, tools or machinery will use up their accumulated reproductive value in the production process and have to be replaced, but not so labour. In this way, a worker could work 8 hours a day, but in 5 hours produce enough value to meet his or her subsistence needs. This means that the value produced in the other 3 hours is surplus value, and since the worker is remunerated only for the cost of reproducing his or her labour, not the full value of the goods or services which their labour creates, it will accrue to the capitalist as profit. Another way of thinking about this is to say that since all commodities exchange on the basis of the labour time that went into their production, including that needed to extract raw materials and build machinery, not just the final manufacturing process, and yet the worker does not receive the full value of the commodity, clearly exploitation exists. However, by treating labour as just another commodity going into the production process alongside raw materials, tools and plant machinery, the capitalist conceals this exploitation in a process which Marx calls commodity fetishism. From this people derive the idea that the capitalist, him or herself, actually creates value too, since they supply the materials and the means of production. But in fact, without the introduction of labour, these commodities are unable to do more than conserve their existing value. The relations of exploitation which were readily apparent under feudalism, where the peasant worked so many days of the year on his own land in order to feed and provide for his own family, and the remainder of on the lands of the local baron, the proceeds of which went to maintain the feudal lord, are under capitalism completely obscured. Under capitalism, unlike feudalism or other pre-capitalist forms of society, commodities are converted into money form only in order to then be exchanged for other commodities. However, in this current epoch, this entire process has stood on its head, so that money or capital now is converted into commodities, means of production, etc., only in order to generate a larger amount of capital. If it did not require the crucial addition of labour power in order to create new value, but could simply increase its own value spontaneously, then there'd be no need for it to engage in the sphere of production at all. Clearly, though, this is not the case. This is significant, particularly when thinking about all the current hype about the new pure form of financial capitalism, in which money supposedly breeds money all by itself, without any reference to the real physical economy. But that's jumping ahead a little. Capitalism, more than any other previous form of economic organisation, is a dynamic system whose fundamental laws of motion are competition and an inherent drive towards expansion. Since all production is subordinated to the need to accumulate more capital, individual capitalists must always strive to increase the level of surplus value they extract from their workers, as well as to sell and produce more commodities. An increase in surplus value can only take place in one of two main ways. Firstly, through the increase in the duration of the working day, absolute surplus value, or secondly, through an increase in productivity through increased levels of mechanisation, speed up, or a more specialised division of labour. This is relative surplus value. The first method, increase in the working day, is generally typical of capitalist development in the period of low technological development, such as Britain in the 19th century. It gradually lost its appeal as larger capitalist firms, which could afford greater outlay of fixed or constant capital and plant machinery, realised greater productivity from their workers, making each individual product or commodity cheaper to produce, and in turn lowering the amount of socially necessary labour time to produce a specific commodity as determined across the whole economy. The smaller capitalists, on the other hand, who relied on more traditional methods of surplus value extraction, were driven from the marketplace. As a result of the compete or sink to the bottom imperative inherent in the capitalist system, from around the end of the 19th century, the advanced capitalist nations of Europe sought to create new markets for their products by the forcible annexation of new colonies in Africa and Asia and their integration into the capitalist system. At the same time, in a parallel development, the major capitalist firms in each industry also sought to form monopolies to prevent the kind of competition that could lead to economic crises and the destruction of capital. By in effect locking up part of their productive capacity, they could control the price of commodities and offset the tendency for the rate of profit to decline with increased investment of constant or fixed capital as opposed to variable capital, i.e. wages. This tendency can be statistically measured if we take the total surplus value and divide it by the sum of capital advanced on both wages and means of production or raw materials. The total amount of surplus value can continue to increase, but because of the increasing ratio of constant versus variable capital, the return on capital investment will actually decrease. This whole process, only partially foreseen by Marx, was brilliantly described by the Russian revolutionary Vladimir Lenin in his pamphlet Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism. However, while competition within national economies was dampened down, conflict between capitalist nations led to the outbreak of World War I and also indirectly World War II. Here the prize at stake was a greater share of an obviously finite world market. Thanks to the destruction of much of the European accumulated capital during the two world wars, as a whole, capitalism as a whole was able to partially overcome for a time its structural tendency towards crisis. Since the 1970s, though, the system has been faced with another crisis of over-accumulation, with a resurgent Japan and Germany, combined with the emerging might of China, challenging the US for global dominance. Even the restoration of capitalism in Russia and Eastern Europe during the 1990s has not been enough to offset this new crisis. Moreover, the tendency for capital tied up in means of production to rise against wage expenditure makes investment in the productive sector less profitable and therefore less attractive to investors. In a bid to bypass the structural conundrum, capital has sought to enlarge the world market through the creation of a gigantic credit or debt bubble, and also through increased investment in areas such as real estate, debt bonds, and foreign currency trading. But the problem for capital generating profits through revenue from interest and from rents, however, is that this entire financial sector is still actually reliant on the extraction, at the end of the day, of surplus value from the working class. As Karl Marx explained in his theories of surplus value, interest and rent and other forms of financial incomes are fundamentally just an apportionment of some of the surplus value created by the worker. Though the relationship between finance sector and the real economy has never been so convoluted and mysterious as it seems today, the reality is that these profits realised by private equity partnerships and speculators have to be paid for out of the profits of the capitalist who's engaged in actual production. However much it might try, capitalism can't simply levitate away from this productive base on some kind of magic carpet. In the long run, the rate of interest and rent is determined by the rate of profit for the ordinary capitalist, which is why the continued expansion of the world market through the extension of credit is such a fundamental necessity to the inhabitants of Wall Street and to the City of London. There's a limit, however, to how far this kind of debt-fueled expansion can go, as New Zealand and the US are both currently finding out. As it requires a massive influx of funds to pay for all the imports, it leads in time to an overaccumulation of capital and the driving of the national currency to unsustainably high levels, at which time a currency crisis is triggered and the entire capital stock, as well as labour power of that nation, is drastically devalued. This has happened recently with the Thai baht and the Brazilian real, and will eventually occur with the New Zealand dollar too, once the gap between the floating value of our currency compared with the actual productive base of the economy grows to the point where international investors start to lose confidence. This has already actually started to happen with the US dollar. I mean, you can look at the rise in debt as a percentage of the total US economy over the last 30 years or so, and you only have to look at the current state of the US dollar now to see that there is a clear relationship there. Another way in which capitalism can try to find a way out of this problem is through the revival of the most primitive, vintage 19th century form of surplus value extraction, making workers work longer and harder through the process of speed up and extension of the working day. Thus, in New Zealand, we've regressed over the last 30-odd years from the 40-hour week to the point where currently in excess of 1 in 5 Kiwi workers puts in more than 50 hours every week. The phenomenon of speed up helps to explain why the value of manufactured goods produced in New Zealand has remained more or less constant over the last few decades, even adjusting for inflation, despite the fact that the sector only employs a small fraction of the workforce it used to. Although some high-profile New Zealand companies, such as Fisher and Paykel, have recently decided to transfer some of their production offshore, this has nothing to do with a lack of productivity on the part of the workforce, but rather, I argue, stems from the desire of these firms to try and escape from the problems of capital overaccumulation, i.e. the high dollar, and an increasing ratio of constant as opposed to variable capital, through migration to a part of the world where the cycle of capital accumulation is currently at a lower point, such as Thailand. Meanwhile, the part of the workforce that is deemed surplus to industry's requirements has found employment increasingly in the non-productive sections of the economy, such as retail, where the only method for companies to increase profits is to hold down wage costs, because they can't actually add any value to the already finished products that they sell. This brings up another interesting contradiction, actually, in capitalism. Under this present system, only labour that realises an exchange value through selling products and services in the market is actually deemed productive, in the sense of creating new surplus value or new value. Labour which does not create surplus value is not productive under capitalism. Yet the very process of capitalism itself tends over time to increase rather than decrease the ranks of these non-productive workers. While some, such as teachers and lawyers, play an important role in providing the system with ideological legitimacy, others, such as supermarket workers, for instance, and the over 500,000 other retail workers in New Zealand, play no obvious role at all in this process. Similar processes are at work in the US as well, where manufacturing now accounts for less than 15% of domestic profits, down from over 50% in the 1960s. As in New Zealand, manufacturing worker productivity has increased. However, in parasite-like fashion, the retail and financial investment sectors have drawn an ever-increasing share of the total profits as capital refuses to invest back into the production process. The irrationality of a system which is constantly overcome by crises of overaccumulation while having an innate inability to fully utilise productive capacity has never been clearer than today. That is why now more than ever, I would argue that it is imperative to arm ourselves with a coherent and powerful critique of capitalism such as only Marxism can provide. Thank you.